In the following audio, author China Mieville delivers a keynote address entitled On Monsters, or Nine or More Monstrous Not Cannies. It was presented at the 33rd Annual International Conference on the Fantastic and the Arts, held in Orlando, Florida in spring 2012. A transcript of this speech is available in the Journal of the Fantastic and the Arts, 23.3, 2012. It was recorded by Michael Arnzen and published on the Popular Uncanny website at gorlitz.com in 2013, and here is used by permission of both Mr. Mieville and the JFA. We begin about 1 minute into the speech when Mieville begins to define the relationship between Freud's notion of the uncanny and literary theories of the fantastic.
The uncanny, that peculiar and unsettling, vaguely supernatural sensation that we all know, is indispensable for any consideration of what kind of affect and milieu it is that spawns monsters. Freud famously associates the uncanny with repetition, with doubles, with pattern recognition where there shouldn't be any patterns, with automata, and most importantly here, with ghosts. As an aside, the teratological, in the sense of monstrous, the teratological status of ghosts is a thorny question, and you can make a very reasonable case, I know, that they aren't really monsters at all. Here I'm going to be talking about monsters as impossible yet inevitable embodiments or enfigurements of the not kenned. So here I am going to count ghosts as monsters, and I hope you will allow it. Freud counts those as the German Heimlich, roughly familiar, with the uncanny, the unheimlich. But key to his argument is that the two terms, while opposites, also bleed into each other. That each, even in the nuances of everyday language, partakes of the other. That there is something creepily estranging in the familiar, and something familiar in the strange. Now, even if you remain politely skeptical about Derrida's extrapolation of all this into claims that the temporally discombobulated ghostly is a, or the, key essence and marrow of all politics and the world, his neologism hauntological, to get at the nature of the spectre and the haunted present, is, I think, very useful. Not least because that hauntological, the ghostly, has such cultural traction, thankfully, for all of us here. The unheimlich, right there in the Heimlich, the ill-tempered child of the Gothic, itself an ill-tempered rebuke to a drably weaponized mercantile industrial canon. Everywhere, the disavowed but recusant familiar, the unforgotten. Sometimes they come back. The soundtrack to modernity is a low, dull, quick sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton, the telltale heart under the floorboards. So, the canny's opposite and rebuke, what constitutes reason sleep, is the uncanny, the return of rest. Or is it? Yes, it is. Right, well, let's move on from that. Is the uncanny the canny's only opposite? Is it from that only that the monsters come? The true weird tale, this is a quote, has something more than secret murder, bloody bones, or a sheeted form clanking chains according to rule. Lovecraft, in what was as close to a manifesto for weird fiction as he ever wrote, explicitly takes the piss out of the appurtenances of the gothic, ghostly, mocking, chain-clanking spooks. So what do we make of the weird? And here, for reasons of time, I'm just going to assert what elsewhere I've tried to argue, of which this is a summary, that there is a meaningfully distinct cluster of texts we can think of and characterize as weird, with a capital W if you're me, because I like capital. What do we make of the weird, a still vigorous and vigorously not canny artistic tradition that, while clearly emerging out of the Gothic, isn't just post-it, but is in crucial ways anti-it? If a ghost is the infigured monstrous of the uncanny, an inadequately battened down guilt function, then what is Cthulhu? For Cthulhu, in its creator's words, there is no language. The thing cannot be described. Even its figurine resembled nothing familiar to geology or mineralogy. The colour out of space, meanwhile, quote, obey laws that are not of our cosmos. The Dunwich horror was an impossibility in a normal world. And it isn't just Lovecraft. In William Hope Hodgson's incomparable The Hog, Carnacki, the ghost finder, trying to explain the outer monstrosities that he faces, repeatedly, poignantly, plaintively inquires of us, I wonder whether you can understand. I wonder if I make it clear to you. I wonder whether I make this clear to you. I wonder if I'm making it at all clear to you. I wonder whether I make it clear. To which the answer, of course, in the face of such neurotically overdetermined desperation for reassurance, has to be, no. No, I'm sorry, not clear at all. These monsters are the opposite of clear. In 1914, in the culmination of Marion Fox's unbelievable anti-classic Ape Space, quote, there came clearly across the downs the sound of an extraordinary onrush. It was not like the sound of the wind. It was the noise of some body in motion, the like of which no one has ever seen. It was a sound quite inexpressible because the thing itself was unknown, unseen, untold. In The Willows, his second greatest story ever of exonerated wilderness, the weird and the melancholy of mute queer longing, the evasive and indescribable presence encountered by Algernon Blackwood's avatar is emphatically not a revenant spirit. What I felt of dread, he says, was no ordinary ghostly fear. As with Lovecraft's tart aside, here the weird is explicitly counterposed to the ontological. It was, he says, infinitely greater and stranger. According to Lovecraft, a certain atmosphere of breathless and unexplainable dread of outer unknown forces must be present in the weird. And however easy it can be to mock that very breathlessness at times, there is something vital about the repetition of these adjectives: unexplainable, outer, unknown, stranger, untold, unseen. I wonder if I make this clear to you. The hauntological is the recurrence of that which we know and which we don't. The most terrible thing about Macbeth's plaintive cry when he sees Banquo's ghost is his lack of surprise. Which of you have done that? The weird and its monsters is and are categorically other. They are fundamentally opposed to that. It's the assertion of that we did not know, we never knew, we could not know, but has always been and will always be unknowable. So this weird affect works not by being knowable, nor by being recalled, but through the assertion of a baleful, a radical otherness, an alterity that's counterposed to everything that we've known or could understand, a complete newness, which is why Lovecraft's repetition of formulations along the lines of nothing like this had ever been seen. This was like no presence that had ever trod the world. I really have to stress to you quite how new this was, and like nothing ever. Far from being completely new at the end of the 19th century, this, though, is, I think, an enmonstered iteration of a long and strong aesthetic tradition, and a philosophical one, one that is endlessly obsessed with questions of the awesome, with a beauty that is terrible and beyond ken, beyond kennable. Since the late 17th century, writers like Wollstonecraft and Anne Radcliffe and Burke and Schopenhauer and Schelling used to wander up mountains to where the fabric of language and the symbolic is at its thinnest and most frayed, and stare out into the geological scale, into the breathtaking abyss of the unrepresentable, and call it the sublime. As early as 1693, John Dennis, crossing the Alps, said that where previously he thought of natural beauty as, quote, a delight that is consistent with reason, the pleasure of that vastness was, quote, mingled with horrors, and sometimes almost with despair. And in the weird, its later echo, the sensation of the numinous remains, but it's a predatory one. It's a predatory unrecognized, it's a bad numinous, manifesting often at a much, much closer scale, right up tentacular in your face, and casually apocalyptic. And that baleful, not canny, is the sublime backwash. So this makes for a peculiar and I think an important troika, because weirdness, which I think is as important a structuring dynamic for the fantastic as the ontological is, weirdness is the antithesis. It's kind of the opposite both of the canny and of the uncanny. So canniness is not a binary, it's a trinary, at least, which we'll be getting on to. So this weird field needs a name, distinguishing it from both of its antipodes, something that best describes the beasts beyond the last redoubt of humanity, to translate it into William Hodgsonian terms, And in homage to my beloved Hodgson, I'm going to pilfer the prefix of which he was endlessly fond for describing exactly these non-human monstrous figures, particularly in his crazed and testerical magnum opus, The Nightland, Ab. So the weird is suffused with abness. This is the Ab canon. The monsters of the Ab canon are teratological expressions of the unrepresentable and the unknowable, the evasive of meaning. Hence, for example, the enormous preponderance of shapeless, oozing gloopiness in the uncanny monstrous, the stress, repeated stress on formlessness, shapes that ostentatiously evade any symbolic decoding by being all and no shapes at once. And those wet, flaccid, liquescent skins also provoke a certain disgust, it's true. But nonetheless, I want to say in passing for those who are into sort of continental theory that the ab in abcani, for me, is as in abnormal and comes from Hodgson and does not signal abjection in particular in the sense that people might find in the work of Julia Kristeva, largely because I find her theory and her psychoanalytical model wholly unconvincing and essentialist. And I should say, by the way, that in this, she's no more of a culprit for me than Lacan or Freud, but the gendered gag reflex that is implied in her theory of the abject, I think is not, in fact, particularly persuasively or strongly argued, and is not, and is also not a sine qua non of the ab cani, as I understand it. And as a second side note, as a meta side note, I want to say that I keep having arguments with people wherein I'll state my disinclination to cite a particular theorist as part of a reading of a text because of my scepticism about that theorist's theory, and my interlocutor will riposte that they're not claiming necessarily to buy the theory wholesale, only to be able to quote, construct interesting readings with it. To which I can only respond in bewilderment that even if they are interesting, surely the truthiness or not of any particular paradigm has some impact on the usefulness of readings. Anyway, back to Kristeva. Or indeed to declining the ab in her abject. Because this is not to say at all that the weird, the very assertion of the unmeanable, isn't deployed to mean things, including to mean gendered spite. As anyone who has read the sadistic and murderously misogynist snuff fantasies of Arthur Machen can attest. But still, I want to respectfully and quite strongly disagree with Stephen King's reading of Cthulhu as a vagina. I think rather that while hardly free of them, Lovecraft, for example, his enmonstered Mishigasses are surprisingly ungendered, in fact, and because everyone knows that what gets his monster-loving blood pumping is race hatred, anti-Semitism, and an ecstatic terror of miscegenation. Such unpleasant meaning, or any of the meanings that the weird might mean, does not preclude, I want to say, the ab canis beyond meaningless, because that's the axis on which it works, and that unmeaningness, that beyond meaningless, the deployment of that, it will inevitably mean with it. The monsters mean while they meta unmean. That works, honestly, trust me. This essential anti-meaningness is at the core of the ab canny, is expressed, I think, beautifully in Tennyson's Kraken, which, along with Victor Hugo's Octopus Nightmare in The Toilers of the Sea and Wells's opaque monster squid in The Sea Raiders, is a foundational text of the pre-weird. And as people know, Tennyson's poem culminates, until the latter fire shall heat the deep, then once by man and angels to be seen, in roaring he, the Kraken, shall rise and on the surface die. When it rises into the sunlight that the poem describes, into the light of visibility and of interpretation, the undescribed Kraken dies. This is a peerless paean and eulogy to semiotic withdrawal. But the poem is not quite that clear, I think, in its counter-canny related allegiance, which is why I think it's actually an interstitial text rather than a truly weird one. Because yes, it is about an ab-canny unknowable, obviously, but there's also something very specific about the beast's abyssalism, its benthic essence, that is designed to make us shiver. Now, there's a very clear overlap here. Because many of our favourite weird monsters do indeed come up from the deep sea. But three things, I think, distinguish the particular and specific flesh creep of the weird from that of the underwater. First, those weirds, like Cthulhu, like Dagon, like Joseph Payne Brennan's slime, retain every scrap of their enormity and their power above the waves. Whereas, second, we know it's when Jaws is tugging on someone from below that it is really scary, in contradistinction. And we all know that the moment that Jaws or Monstro breaks the surface and emerges is inevitable, because it's the telos of the subaquatic monstrous, it's also always a disappointment. Which is why this is better monster than this. And why the single greatest moment in this particular monstrous history is this. After this bowel-wateringly terrifying moment, the fish grabs him, the fish pulls him down without ever breaking the surface. And ladies and gentlemen, I give you the apotheosis and zenith of the monstrous subcanny. The last piece of evidence for the existence and specificity of the subcanny as distinct from the uncanny and the adcanny is that part of that subcanny frisson does not follow its piscine bearers out of the water. We explorers from the canny do experience it the instant we breach the meniscus ourselves and descend, as anyone who dives knows. I looked out over the tossing ocean and the sinking sun and realised what I had been permitted to see almost half a mile below the surface. I knew that I should never again look upon the stars without remembering their active, living counterparts swimming about in that terrific pressure. It leaves the mind in a maze of wonder to think of having seen these hidden multitudes, delicate and fragile, moving swiftly on their missions in life amid black, ice-cold water. This strange world, when once it has been seen, will remain forever the most vivid memory in life, solely because of its cosmic chill and isolation, the eternal and absolute darkness, and the indescribable beauty of its inhabitants. These are the words of William Beebe, the bathyscape pioneer from 1934, breathless with a near religious ecstasy of someone who has glimpsed beyond the canny. And as we know, ecstasy is only a short hop to terror. So what are then the specifics of the not canny of the thing below water? Because Jeremy Fisher never repressed this trout. Jeremy Fisher has always known trout exist, but he also knows that in themselves they are monsters beyond his batrachian ken. This moment, in fact, represents the actualization of his worst nightmares, but nightmares of which he was already afraid. So to wax Rumsfeldian for a moment, if the uncanny is carried by the unknown knowns, the weird by the unknown unknowns, then the subcanny is an expression of the known unknowns. Name. Now, somewhat nervously, but quite giddily, I'm gonna move pell-mell on, because categorizing is intoxicating. Prefixes are like margaritas. Because after all, water isn't the only thing under which lurk beasts. If we've opened the conceptual door to underneathness as an axis of the counter-canny, then what about this? Footloose schmutloose, right? Kevin Bacon's finest hour. Cryptozoological Mongolian bloodworms, sandworms on many of the tables here, those giant spice poopers, petty burrowers, Albinsons and Negarastani sentient oil and rat swarms and machines digging. The ground beneath our feet is teeming with chthonic monsters. Tellurian presences that are chewing through earth and nestling in burrows and that reach up and snag and snare and pull back down into shifting dirt. And what kind of not-canny is this? Because to be distinct, even if inevitably overlapping, often in the figure of the same monster, to which I'll come, to be distinct from the un and the ab, and most of all from the sub-canny, these monsters need to embody their own rebuke to the nostrums of the known. So how about this? The ground beneath our feet, the literal Grundnorm of our conception of things, of the everyday itself, is Swiss cheese. It isn't safe. You tread too hard, you get sinkholes. It's not their mere underneathness in which these tunnelers' fearfulness lies. It's in their tunnelingness, their destabilization of the ground on which we walk. Up from a trodden pathway might come giant antlion jaws, and then we're gone. These monsters are vectors of a hollow earth, and they're vermiform vectors with teeth. With the subcanny, that's the sea, remember, we know we're not on solid ground, definitionally. The deep sea is a known unknown. Here, though, the terror is in the rebuke to the complacency of our ground-walking swagger, our unconscionable arrogance in believing that we can safely put one foot in front of another. So it's not quite simply guilt, nor anti-revelation, nor the verification of deep fears. What this is that we can feel rumbling through our feet is the monstrous undermining of our certainties. It is the catechany. And the Greek does work, I check. Don't try and stop me now. The test of any categorizer's drive, its motor, isn't the uncontroversial case, it's the counterintuitive ones. And where there's a cluster of oddities that good sense, that canny sense wouldn't predict, you might, for example, derive the uncanny and possibly even the uncanny from the canny, and you might predict that in a world with fish and worms in it, you'd get some kind of southern catacanny. And even, I'd go further, given how much crap we throw away all the time, it's perhaps not a surprise that tides and dunes and worlds made of trash are not new conceits in fantastic fiction. And you can think of examples like Charles Platt's Garbage World, Philip K. Dick's Kipple and Gubbish, Ellis Sharp's wonderful The Dump, the best scene in the movie Labyrinth, and so on. This is not a great surprise. Monstrous insurgent garbage, however, seems slightly less self-evident. It's everywhere. It is everywhere. And Hedora, and Trubbish, for any Pokemon fans out there, and the 1970s micro-budget movie The Bill Peters Monster, and Joseph DeLacy's recent book Garbage Man, and Marjorie the Trash Heap in Fraggle Rock, and on and on and on. Monstrous garbage is everywhere. Even proper literary types are in on this game. In Toward the End of Time, Updike talks about, with the usual facility of those external to genre with their nomenclature, of the metallobioforms that have evolved out of discarded toxic waste. And yes, of course, these can be deployed to make legitimate, if rather clunky, points about environmental degradation, or worse, to de-gut their own terribleness and act as some kind of awful, weak comprador to human bureaucratic instrumentalism, finger-waggingly insisting on the necessity of recycling. We talked yesterday about the domesticated monster and figures like this and none more. In these iterations, we're not really talking so much about garbage monsters as irate litter. litter. As anyone who's read Heather Rogers' fantastic book Gone Tomorrow, People's History of Garbage, knows, was a blame-avoiding invention of America's packaging industrial complex. That's true. Even so degraded, however, that those particular monsters at root are more resonant, these rubbish monsters. They were thrown out, not repressed. They're not under anything, necessarily, and if anything, they fill up holes. So crucially, we may not know them now, but we certainly did once, and that's got to be enough to merit a prefix. This is the post-canon.
Isn't that objection?
The insurgent discarded, that we no longer understand. The cycle of genus generation is accelerating, and I'm loving it. So where do we go now? Well, there are two down below counter-canons. What about the monsters of the above one? What unites the Shatner-harassing airplane gremlin of the Twilight Zone with the bureaucratically alien monarchist sky dwellers of the only science fiction novel by Christopher Caldwell, the theorist of the uncanny, editor of ghost stories, Marxist theorist and martyr in the Spanish Civil War? With the air jungle ecosystems and gelatinous monsters of Conan Doyle's The Horror of the Heights, with, even if just for its title, 1952's Zombies of the Stratosphere. How about what we're looking at here is that the sublimated, rather than the sublime, the heaven proximate, the non-earthbound, is not, in fact, an emancipation from this veil of tears at all. And thus, the disbelief, the terror of the wrongness of our own sky-staring escapism is the Circan. Or if you're a Hellenophile, the Anacan. More. So have you got anything particularly theoretically juicy, I hear you ask? An elision, for example, between recent academic speculations and the not canny as a breathless aesthetic. Yes, I have. Probably the most trendy of movements in philosophical theory at the moment is so-called speculative realism. One of its pin-up stars is the French philosopher Quentin Meyersou, who updates Bishop Berkeley by drawing a disdainful disproof of the linguistic term, of any notion that the world is inextricable from our thought and language, by focusing on what he calls the archifossil, the trace of events that have happened vastly before any human thought. I am going somewhere with this. Now, the parameters and eccentricities and increasingly unconvincing claims of speculative realism are way beyond me here. But even if it doesn't quite do the heavy theoretical lifting it's intended to, this particular construction of the archifossil strikes a loud chord. It's a considerably footnoted version of that very stomach-pitching wonder that we feel and recognise staring at a trilobite or an ammonite or any bones made of stone, any fossil. A preemptive rebuke to our epistemology, a pre-echo from long before our ken. There's awe in all the warnings in horror about the sheer antiquity of the monster, and what else can that anxiety that the canny is a parvenu paradigm be but the pre-canny? In 1938, André Breton and Jacqueline Lambert and Yves Tanguy, they get together, as the surrealists have for many years, and they fold in past paper and they scrawl, and they create the dream counter-canny of random teratology, epiphany through chance. So what are we going to call this? The juxta-canny. William Wilson, the doppelganger. Whatever Freud says, this is not the uncanny. This doppelganger hasn't returned. The problem, rather, is that it's simultaneous to itself. So is this a monster of the re-canny? Well, no, because that still implies a certain temporality. That implies a once after the otherness. But you've got to give me a moment. What this is a self-standing by itself. This is about the horror of besideness, of next-to-ism. So what we're in the realm of here is the paracanny. Computers that take apocalyptically over because of their surplus logic, their excess rigour, their malevolently totalitarian and anti-human reason, reason against itself, the accursed share of rationality, the autophagous canny, the super canny. Now, obviously, as I say, there's going to be overlap. If you've got the ghost of a submariner is sub-canny and uncanny. The zombie of the stratosphere is un- and anacanny. Cthulhu is ab-canny with shades of sub- and pre-canny. I could go on. I will go on. Because there's got to be a more efficient way of doing this now that we've got the head of steam. So why don't we turn the methodology on its head? Rather than proceeding by the excruciating glacial method of actually trying to work out ways of understanding what's out there in the world, or in the world of monsters, why don't we render our divisions first, then shove reality into those Procrustean little legs? So what we need is a list of prefixes, and suture them to canny, and then go hunting for evidence. So I'm here to crowdsource. I'm casting for examples of the intercanny, the hemicanny, the monocanny, the pericanny, and the epicanny. And any others that you might be interested in coming. Now, two key questions follow from all of this. And the first and most obvious is, what about dragons? And the second question, and it is related to the first question, as all questions are, is, What are we even talking about? Are we actually talking about anything anymore? Were we ever talking about anything? You taxonomic frenzy, you drive to categorize, you demented and enthusiastic crank Linnaeanism, you are the source of our geek superpowers and of our relentless capacity to completely ruin what we love. Don't let me be unclear. I speak as a friend. Canniness definitely contains its own antigens or enemies or disparate shades or antitheses or opposites or contraries or reflections or whatever other metaphor you want to use. Indeed, monsters. Of which monsters themselves are the most endlessly proliferative delight and example. And of those, the uncanny is, however you theorize it, absolutely key. It is not mere contingency or conceit that it is a peg for a cottage academic industry. And I'll go further. I will demand a minimum of 3 points to the opposites triangle when it comes to reason, its sleep, and its absence. I will vigorously defend the uncanny as a heuristic, a vital conceptual tool. I genuinely and sincerely think it furthers the understanding of a whole fantastic subtradition and drive that has long existed in gnarly, conflictual, mutual gnawing with the uncanny. I've even argued that the history of the fantastic for more than a century has been characterized in particular by an oscillation between the un and the uncanny, particularly in the monstrous. And beyond that, the post-canny, I'm persuaded, is somewhat persuasive. The sub-canny, I don't know. I think that there might be something to it. The anacanny, I thought I was probably joking. Going back to write this, have you read The Horror of the Heights? But it's still pushing it a bit, right? The catacanny, maybe. The pericanny? I don't know. Even if there is a point to any of these, even if you can take the understanding of the marine monstrous forward with the subcanny, say, the drive to translate what may even be useful, fleeting and evanescently useful constructs, to translate them into foundations for analysis can be deadly. Sometimes it's okay for theoretical derivation to be sufficient rather than necessary. People are probably familiar with the Celestial Emporium of Benevolent Knowledge's taxonomy, the system of classification that Borges claimed was in a Chinese encyclopedia, according to which beasts are famously divided into those that belong to the emperor, embalmed ones, those that are trained, suckling pigs, mermaids, fabulous ones, stray dogs, those included in this classification, those that tremble as if they were mad, innumerable ones, those drawn with a fine camel hair brush, etc., those that have just broken the flower vase, and those that at a distance resemble flies. An immensely influential list, a list on which Foucault bases his whole discussion in The Order of Things, a list which has been used as a peg to discuss post-colonialism, the arbitrariness or cultural specificity of knowledge and organisation, often with a startling degree of Orientalism, a list that's been used as a supposed deconstruction of rigid categories and so on, and also, and importantly, a list that a genuinely shocking number of readers and writers, including academics, seem not to realise it's not real. It's a work of fiction. A list, then, perhaps the key wisdom of which is not epistemological but aesthetic, to wit, that taxonomy is unspeakably enjoyable. It's a performance, and it's one that we do very well. Classification may very well not be useless, but it's never analysis. No matter how baroquely detailed and comprehensive seeming its categories are, at best it begs questions. At worst it's presumptuous and theoretically totalitarian and replaces understanding with filing. We've all heard papers where categories are the driving force, according to which the way to understand literature or whatever is to work out which title fits where, as if literary theory was a giant card catalogue. And even when the last book has been slotted neatly into the last of the holes that were cut to be filled with holes, with books, what we have are books in neat piles. Which is not nothing, but it's not that much. So even if someone was convinced by the usefulness of every one of the, I think, 14 counter candies mentioned here, and I think they would be insane, the point, surely, is not immediately to say, well, what about this book? Which counter candy is that? Is Monster X or Demon Y pericandy? Is it monocandy? Is it super candy? And I say that plaintively because not because I don't get the desire to do that. I played D&D for many years. But it doesn't necessarily matter where this leaves dragons, in other words, or any other favourite monster. None of this may have anything pertinent to say about this or that draconine question at all. None of these categories that I've been developing, neither the important inner core that I will defend to the hilt, nor the frankly questionable penumbra, claim to or have to cover all iterations of the fantastic, monstrous, or otherwise. All they have to do, I want to suggest, to be really worth talking about, is two things. First, it would be great if at least one or two of them, as it is my aspiration, for example, for the Ab County to do, not merely to pile up monsters in big, impossible-bodied scree, but get at how and why and to what end these monsters do what they do. And the second thing that these categories have to do, all of them, whatever their status, their very citation, as well, perhaps in a best-case scenario, as maybe making some sense, should, like the beasts that belong to the Emperor, like the beasts that from far away resemble flies, entertain, as I hope they have done here. Thank you.
So much to think about, the taxonomy of the weird, and we've all been given a heuristic, and we use it. We will see. Thank you so much, China. It was terrific.